The R 1015 have arrived. We'll call the House Tax Committee to order. We have a full agenda for today, and we will go right in order the order we have. But before we move on, Representative Weiner moves the minutes of March 11th. Any additions or corrections? Hearing none, all favors say aye. Those opposed say nay. Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Weiner. First bill, O'Driscoll, House File 355. If you would like to come to the testifying table, Mr. Chairman. I will move House File 355, and the motion will be to lay over possible inclusion in the awesome omnibus tax bill. So I will move House File 355 to your bill, Chair O'Driscoll. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee. What House File 355 does, and it's something I've been attempting to try to do for a number of years here in the legislature, is it adjusts the income tax credit that Minnesotans can take advantage of for purchasing qualified long-term care coverage. What we know is there's kind of three groups of folks that would, from an economic standpoint, that you'd find. Those who have means who would probably not purchase a long-term care policy for their needs because they've got the means, they've got the resources. On the other end, people who don't have means and resources, the social safety network is there to help those folks. What this credit is designed to do is to encourage the middle class to be able to purchase and sustain paying premiums on a long-term care policy. And it's been at $100 for an individual per year and $200 for a couple, married couple, for years and years and years. And the cost of those premiums are going up, and a way to try to encourage people to stay with those premiums, keep paying those premiums and keep that coverage and protect themselves as the middle class is to offer incentives for folks. And so this simply does an adjustment of 100 to 250 for individuals and from 200 to 500 for married couples. Mr. Chair, that is the extent of the bill.
Thank you very much. I have one testifier, Bob Stein. Is there anyone else in the audience that would like to testify on this? For or with concerns, does the department wish to testify on this bill? Who are you? Oh, so nice to meet you. Nice. Oh, you were here before. Okay. I'm looking over there and I'm going, who is that? Okay. But before we do that, we want to introduce high school pages that are with us today. If you could please stand up and kind of just form a row. You'll be asked the typical questions that pages are asked by the tax committee. Please state your name, who your state rep is, and who your school mascot is.
My name is Maria Deloza. My state representative is Kristen Bonner, and my high school mascot is a Maple Leaf.
A Maple Leaf.
Shout out to Maple Grove. I'm next to expect.
Let's go fight the Maple Leafs.
Fear the Leafs, Mr. Chair.
I bet they're tough.
Fear the Leaf. That's our hashtag.
Fear the Leaf?
Fear the Leaf.
When I wrestled, we'd go wrestle at Blooming Prairie, home of the Blossoms. It was really embarrassing to lose to a Blossom. Okay, sir.
My name is Daniel. My representative is John Kosnick. Woo!
Brought him right out of his seat.
My school are the Cougars.
So that's south or north?
Yes, south.
South, okay. Islanders. Okay. Iowans? No.
I'm Hippie. My representative is Josh Heinzman, and my mascot is the Warriors.
Warriors. All right. Let's go back over here.
My name is Abby. My representative is Jimmy Gordon, and we have Blue Jackets.
Blue Jackets? Okay.
My name is Emma. My representative is Katie Scott, and our mascot is the Huskies.
Huskies. Okay. Cardinals.
My name is Matthew. My representative is Ethan Shaw, and my school mascot is
the
what?
A lion.
Lion.
Oh, a lion. Lion. Okay. One. Maple Leafs. I got to look that one up. Could I talk to you later about that?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
Fill me in. Okay. Thank you for being here. Okay, let's go to the witness. Please state your name and who you represent for the record, please, sir.
Mr. Chair, committee members, my name is Bob Stein. I am the legislative committee co-chair for the National Association of Benefit Insurance Professionals in Minnesota. I am also an independent agent representing small employers throughout the state. We support Representative O'Driscoll's bill to increase the long-term care insurance tax credit. The current long-term care tax credit was passed into law in 97 and as part of the Project 2030 to address the impending age wave of baby boomers retiring and needing long-term care. The oldest Minnesotans in the group are now turning 80, and the need is high as predicted, creating a strain on the state Medicaid long-term care budget. Since the amount has never been adjusted for inflation, we support this bill to increase the incentive for Minnesotans to get insured with long-term care insurance so they don't have to be burdened by the state budget. It is not too late to make a meaningful impact on the future of human services budget by incentivizing Minnesotans to put their own funds on the table to ensure that they can afford a long-term care needs without having to rely on the taxpayers' Medicaid. We encourage you to include this bill in your final tax bill to make the incentive meaningful for the future budgets and especially for this new gray wave that's coming. We figure that the tax credit will make the tax advisors actually advise people to purchase long-term care coverage.
Okay, thank you. Any questions for Mr. Stein? And to nonpartisan staff, and I don't know if this can if you could even calculate this anyway, so I'm not going to ask today, but my question is if more people would take advantage of this credit and get long-term care, how much would that save the state budget? And I don't know that you can even figure that out, but it would be millions and millions of dollars if we can keep them on a private long-term care plan rather than going on the state through spend down. So any other questions for the author? If the author would like, Representative Lee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I don't have an answer to your question, but I just would want to comment and say that long-term care and long-term care insurance is an issue that a lot of folks in Minnesota have been working on for a very, very long time, and it's kind of a fraught issue because it's just something that we haven't invested in enough, right? And so appreciate this proposal before us today. I know Representative O'Driscoll has brought it before us many times, but I think, you know, the majority of people, you know, we are recognizing need this kind of care, and I think the question is just how we're going to pay for it. And I know earlier in the session we brought up the question of, you know, what does fair share mean? And in the author's testimony, he mentioned that, you know, this tax credit is meant to incentivize middle class folks to invest in, you know, their care later to ease the burden on the system. But I just point us to the latest tax expenditure report that actually 30% of the people who've taken advantage of the credit as is are in the top income tier, and 50% of people, you know, make more than $127,000 a year. And so for me, I think this is a problem that we want to solve on both sides of the aisle. I just think this is something that we should keep in mind, that maybe this is not the right solution, but like we should keep exploring what options look like, especially as, you know, there are impending cuts to human services coming at the federal level, and we don't know what that will look like on our state budget. Thanks.
Thank you, Representative Lee. Representative Elkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My wife and I are among the few people probably who have these kinds of policies. We've been paying premiums on them for probably 20 years now. We did the right thing and started buying them when we were in our you know 40s and 50s, and the premiums have now, they go up every year. We're, for the two of us, we're paying probably $4,000 a year, but if the alternative is that you know you wait until you really need the care, and then you spend off your entire inheritance that you're planning to pass on to your children to impoverish yourself so that you can get onto Medicaid and have Medicaid pay your nursing home expenses. But that, you know, if we look at the, you know, what is the source of our budget deficit in 20s, you know, in the out years and the tails of our current budgets, that's where it all is. It's increasing nursing home costs for people who have impoverished themselves to get Medicaid to pay their nursing home costs. So this long-term care market is surely epitome of an insurance death spiral right now. I don't know how we get out of it. My advice to a younger person would be to buy a hybrid life policy that allows you to draw down your life insurance proceeds in advance to pay for your end-of-life nursing home care. I've got that, too. But if somebody new coming into it, that's probably the best way to go right now.
I think you're right, Representative Elkins. This is actually a big part of my business in that the long-term care policies are tough to sell because if you don't use it, you lose it. But the hybrids you were talking about are very popular. I do a ton of those because if you don't use it, you don't lose it. It's going to be there at some point. So, and as far as the upper scale earners versus lower scale earners, the lower scale earners don't have much to spend down, and they get right on the system. It's trying to protect other people from spend downs. And I have two trains of thought about it, and it's when I have clients that I didn't get to early enough and they have to go into spend down, it kills me. It just their whole life savings is gone. On the other hand, why should Representative Elkins have to pay for my long-term care? You know, and so there's kind of two ways to look at it. But would you like any other questions? Thank you for that, Representative Elkins. Chair Gomez?
I guess I'm curious because, you know, I've never served on commerce. I don't know a lot about insurance, but I have just kind of been reading up a little bit on this, and it seems that it's highly underutilized compared to the need, as Representative Lee was talking about. Prices are going up. Denials are going up. The utility of this instrument is, I mean, highly questionable at this point, I would say. So I'm just curious, you know, Representative Elkins has served on commerce, I think, at least a couple terms, I know, and referred to it as a classic insurance company death spiral, which was quite a turn of phrase, Representative Elkins. So I guess I'm just wondering, like, if the people who are bringing this bill forward and proposing that we basically put $30 million, a biennium, into what it may or may not be a classic insurance company death spiral. I'm just curious about if you have comments on that. And, you know, we do policy in the legislature to solve problems. This is a huge problem, as our colleagues pointed out.
Recording in progress.
Oh, good.
I don't want to be able to listen. To
yeah, I'm sure. Yeah. Yep, David wants to come back.
Gomez, would you start again? Could you start again so we get that on the record?
From the top, no. But yeah, I mean, so we're throwing $30 million at this. Maybe it's sort of a solution for like some tiny fraction of the people who are facing this issue, as we're facing down a multi-billion dollar problem, which is manifesting itself in this huge imbalance. In a structural imbalance in the tails. And so, like, how is this not just, like, classic throwing good money after bad? You're saying that it's, because, like, an insurance company is making money off of this. Like, you're not doing this out of the kindness of your heart. You're not providing this service out of the kindness of your heart, presumably. You're turning a profit. And so what we're saying is this profit center for insurance companies is going so badly that we have to throw another $30 million at it that's not actually solving our big picture problem. And so I'm just curious about what the actual like policy intent of this is. Like, is $250 going to incentivize somebody to buy a multi-thousand dollar per year insurance plan that they may or may not be able to use later, depending on whether, you know, the system exists in 20 years, the insurance company decides to arbitrarily deny coverage, which is the entire business model of insurance, from what I understand, charge the highest premiums you possibly can, deny as much care as you possibly can, and reap all the profits. That's what it looks like, and the economy's happening. So I just wonder if you have any comments, either the author or the testifier, on like what we're trying to do here.
Okay, couple things. Representative Elkins.
Yeah, I'll take a stab at this one, Mr. Chair. I think the objective is to enable people who have been paying into these policies for maybe 15 or 20 years in good faith to be able to afford to keep them instead of just abandoning them and throwing themselves on the mercy of the Medicaid market.
Yes, and to Chair Gomez's comments about denials, I have never run in. I've been doing this over 40 years. I've never run into a long-term care policy claim that was denied. It's very simple. You can't do two of the six activities of daily living. The doctor says you can't do two of the six, insurance company has to pay. And the insurance companies are not making bazillions on this. In fact, there's very few insurance companies even in the market in Minnesota because it's a loser. Chair O'Driscoll, and then we'll go to Chair Gomez.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The testifier has a copy of the fiscal note, and I know the committee does as well. The $30 million that was quoted by Chair Gomez isn't really what the fiscal note had indicated. It's closer to between $13 and $14 million is what I saw. So I just thought I would mention that.
That's biennium versus year, Mr. Chair.
Yeah. And then to that point, though, go ahead, Chair Gomez.
Well, okay, so you just said, quote, it's a loser. So we're spending $30 million on this thing that's a loser. Like, what are we doing here?
Well, it's a loser. To suggest that insurance companies that this is a pot of gold for them is not the case. It's not the case, and they're struggling to keep going in this market. And would a couple of $500 incentive make somebody keep their policy? It could. You'd be surprised how, hey, I got that tax deal from the state because I kept these policies. So, and when I say it's a loser, that I should have said that many of the companies do lose money on these. So it's not like this is, right, you know, the big windfall for them.
Yeah, so Mr. Chair, I mean, again, apologies because we have to kind of like, we do a lot of things in taxes about and cover topics that I don't have the depth in, obviously, that you do. But to say that this industry is going to like exist in a decade or two if it's a losing money for profit motivated companies? Like, as I said, I mean, it may be like insurance companies do not provide insurance out of the kindness of their heart. They do it to make money. And so if this isn't making them money, like, presumably they, you know, if Representative Elkins and Mrs. Elkins have been paying into their policy for decades, they would hopefully get some benefit from it at some point, I would hope. We're knocking on wood here. But like, I guess I'm curious about if this is a loser, if it's losing insurance companies money, then like, is this product going to continue to exist? And if it seems like it's in one of these classic insurance company death spirals, why would we throw money into the death spiral to just be sucked down into the hole?
Mr. Stein?
Yes.
Help, Mr. Stein.
I've been doing this now for 35 years. I've been selling long-term care policies for that many years. They don't just go away. They're non-cancelable, most of the contracts. So they'll stay with that person for forever. But what does happen is that if the plan doesn't become affordable, or if it, you know, does the death spiral, it no longer is being sold. And then different policies come out and on top of that. And what we were talking about before is certain like cash value policies. Those are the ones that continue for the rest of people's lives. And those are the ones that we can see in the future are going to continue. So some of the ones that you're talking about, we had the death spiral, they're gone. We used to sell group plans to small employers. That went away a couple of years ago. Now they're coming back again with a universal life or some kind of cash value program to it. So they are morphing to be incentivizing people to purchase them. And so I think the insurance companies have figured it out to make them be around for years.
Well, Mr. Stein, or to the author, we're talking about two different things here. You've got your classic long-term care policies, then you've got the ones Representative Elkins referred to that are kind of a hybrid life insurance, and I'm much more comfortable with those because there are fewer and fewer companies doing the classic type contracts. There are more. Would this apply to someone that purchases an investment-grade cash value life insurance policy that has a long-term care benefit on it with a 2 of 6? Would this apply to that, or is it just the classic long-term care policies? Chair O'Driscoll.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. It applies to the provision under the current law, which I believe is just the traditional long-term care policy. To the point of a hybrid policy, I have been very, very a big proponent of that. And in a perfect world, I'd like to increase the amount of the credit. And I'd rather we incentivize people to the policy for your life. We have a life insurance policy, so if you're younger, have a family, something happens, there are resources that are there. As you get older and you need the long-term care, it can convert into a long-term care policy where it can cover your daily needs should you meet the requirements, 2 of the 6 activities of daily living that would no longer be, you could no longer do on your own, which would make the policy eligible. I think you're going to get efficiencies in the policy that way. I think you're going to get more people who are going to buy that. You're going to get a lot of younger people if there's a tax credit on there to be able to buy the proper amount of life insurance. And what we're doing is we're taking people away from the need to be on that social network and that social safety net. And the dollars that we just saw in the forecast show that in the biennium, that's the peak around the curtain where there's the deficit, that for the first time in Minnesota's history, Health and Human Services are going to eclipse the amount of money that we pay in K-12 education. These kinds of things, and I want to get the conversation going, and I'm happy to change this to a, at some point if we want to, incentivize people, increase the credit, encourage people of all ages to buy insurance. That's a policy for life. We're going to be able to help bend that curve because people are going to be able to afford those policies.
And Mr. Chairman, that's why I asked the first question I asked was to research, and I know we can't probably figure this out, but, well, research, they can figure anything out. I shouldn't have just cut you off there, Mr. Williams. I'm sorry. But the question is, by doing this $30 million or whatever the number is, how much does the state save? It would have to be hundreds of millions. If people had long-term care policies, because each one might be worth $300,000-$400,000 a pop, and it doesn't take long to take care of the $30 million. So we're just seeing the expense. We're not seeing the benefits of the coverage for people, and that's the number I wish I could figure out. But so let's move on here. We have you'll wrap it up, Representative Lee.
Thank you, Chair. I just wanted to add maybe some research points to the discussion. So, I mean, we're talking about a lot of things here, right? I know, so the author mentioned expanding the pool, getting young people to potentially also pay for this. This is a very similar discussion that we had with, like, health insurance, which is a different motivation, right? But I think the question here is also, you know, do people believe that they will be able to make claims? And so I want to point folks to an article from the Star Tribune last June, and I want to read from it really quickly, that it says that in Minnesota, actually, we have the second highest rate of denial across the country. And so that's not good. And for a young person who is going to spend many years paying into this policy, right, it means you're taking a gamble on perhaps losing out on this money later. And so it just mentions here, Minnesota insurers denied almost 9% of long-term care benefit payments in 2022, the second highest rate in the nation, according to the National Association of Insurance Commissioners. It also denied 24% of claims in their first attempts to qualify for benefits, which is an increase from 20% in 2018. And so again, this is a really big problem, and I think we can acknowledge that. I think the question is just, you know, is this tax credit the best solution? And maybe, you know, we need to do more. Thanks.
Thank you, Representative Lee. And as far as the denials, they must not have very good insurance agents. I'll bet you. Mr. Stein, have you ever had one denied?
Never. No, I've never had any kind of.
He's really good. And so where you come up with this denial base, I'm going, what are you talking about? But that's what you're talking about.
Read it in the paper, yeah.
It was just in the papers. It must have been online, so it's got to be true. Chair Gomez, to wrap this up, then we're going to move forward. Thank you, Representative Lee, for those comments. Representative Herr, I'm sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I wasn't going to say anything, but this conversation, Representative Driscoll and I just had a hearing in Commerce regarding HOA fees. And I think about all of the people who get to have different types of tax credits or who's...
Whoa.
Okay.
Nathan, you okay?
Yeah, I'm okay. My apologies.
Okay. Okay.
This is so upsetting. Nathan fell. I cannot believe
it. He just heard his claim was denied. So, sorry. Reps have her.
And I was just thinking about how when we look at certain industries and we say, you know, part of the reason why HOA fees, individuals are not able to get coverage is because they're considered high risk, right? Like private insurers. They have to go to a different market in order to buy insurance for their homeowners because they're considered high risk because of all the assessments on what has happened with the environment. And then I think about the fact that, like, we can do all of that fancy work in the insurance industry to identify who is high risk, what's it going to cost, how are they going to be profitable. But then in something like this where we know it, based on health trends and outcomes what the risk is going to be and the cost of it, and that, like, we are constantly on one end saying, how do we adjust and support the insurance industry? Because insurance is really important. I'm somebody who is way overinsured in all the ways that I shouldn't be either, because I'm very risk averse. But as we have these conversations, it is not lost upon me of, like, as Representative Lee mentioned, of, like, who benefits for something like this. And I think about these products. They're not made for people like certain from my communities, right? People who have long-term care look different in their communities and how they care for their elderly. Like, we don't have an insurance product we can buy to actually support how we do that, right? And so, like, I guess it's not as much of a question, but just a commentary on how we choose to then, when we defend the insurance company and we talk about they're providing this great product and it's really important and it's not profitable, but they're still doing it. But yet, in every other way, like, the consumers are being charged a ton of money for things that are high risk, and it makes it very difficult for them. And so I think about, if we're going to be looking at tax credits for this, does this bring us down a slippery slope of, like, everybody then saying, well, we're in an industry in which we're charged something and the fee's outrageous, maybe we all should have tax credits? Because a lot of townhome owners and condo owners who are paying these excessive high rates for HOAs and then their own homeowners insurance on top of that, maybe we should be giving them tax breaks too. We should be looking at all of the ways in which individuals should have access to being able to offset these fees. And so I just think that consistency with what we do and who we do it with is really important. And I feel like we don't do that. And we're not saying just in taxes, I say all over the place, we don't do that. And to Chair David's, your point about how we either pay for something now or we pay for it later, right? Like, we're saving people in the long run. We can make that argument in everything, in education, and that if we just put more into education, we would save on the cost of it in society later on. If we put more into public safety, if we put more into, you know, insurance premium coverage and state stepping up and paying for that, we would be saving in health disparity outcomes later on. We absolutely could be doing that. And I think that if we're going to make a case for this and pass this, we should be doing a lot of other things, that, like, my fifth tier tax bill and some of the other things I think are really important in tax realm too. So I know that was a lot. It was really convoluted, but I couldn't help but think about that considering the conversation we had this morning and how those who are trying to have affordable housing by buying townhouses and condos are paying absorbent fees, and we don't give them any kind of offsets in order to do that either. So thank you.
Thank you. You want to wrap it up, Chair Gomez?
Yeah, please. Thank you. Okay, so this is kind of a classic example of why you cannot individual tax credit your way out of huge societal problems. You just can't do it. We think in tax committee sometimes, oh, if we do, like, a little individual tax credit, then that, like, we're throwing a Band-Aid on a bullet wound here. We are literally talking about throwing $30 million down the classic insurance company death spiral when we have a multi-billion dollar issue facing us, facing our budget. And so we have choices in front of us. We have difficult choices. When you have an imbalance between the services that you're offering and the money that you're bringing in, you can either bring in more money or you can cut services. At some point, that is the choice in front of us. So, you know, I mean, this is just, like, interesting to me because, you know, there were dozens of companies that sold these instruments to Minnesotans, and who, you know, to the testifier's point, these you can't just kick somebody off this insurance. If Mr. and Mrs. Elkins have been paying in since they were in their 40s, and they're now in their, I don't know, 60s, 70s, 70s, 50s, whatever. 50. Who's counting? You know, you can't just, these guys aren't going to be out in the cold. So what we have right now is there are only three companies in Minnesota who will even sell one of these things to you because they're such a loser, as the chair said, right? They are so inadequate to meet the problem that we're facing in our budget. And so, you know, the question before us is simple. It's like, are we going to throw some good money after bad? Are we going to throw a $30 million? That's biennium, $28 million per biennium. I wasn't talking about annual costs, Chair O'Driscoll. But are we going to spend $30 million to put one of those itty-bitty Band-Aids on this big, gushing bullet wound in front of us? $30 million that will only go to help people who can afford to buy this expensive and potentially low value insurance instrument. You have to get approval from Commerce to raise the premiums, and they have gotten approval from Commerce to raise premiums. But there's more and more pressure to raise premiums, and they're facing a similar issue that we're facing in our budget. It's about money you're bringing in versus money that's going out. The cost of long-term care is incredibly expensive. So the insurance companies have to do the same thing that we have to do. But you guys have to profit, too. So that's the additional wrinkle, right, when we're talking about spending tax money to subsidize a private company that's providing a service to people to meet a giant societal need. Is the insurance companies are basically like the middleman, and they have to get their piece, too. So, you know, I mean, obviously, I'm still thinking about whether I support this or not, Mr. Chair. But
well, Chair Gomez, I'm going to put you down as a maybe.
Put me down as a maybe, please. Okay. So, yeah, I mean, I think this is a really unwise use of public money. I just have questions about, you know, how much an additional $250 a year, how much of an incentive that's going to provide for somebody who wouldn't otherwise buy one of these products to buy it, because that's like when we spend money in taxes, we're saying we're trying to incentivize behavior, we're trying to change behavior on something like this, because in order for this to actually have a positive impact on our budget going down the road, people have to buy these things. And I mean, I'm really glad that we asked the question of whether the instrument that actually works, potentially, I mean, you're basically buying down your insurance, life insurance money that you would pass on to your kids or whatever, so that's a question, right? But the instrument that actually works, that the industry is moving toward offering, that, you know, Chair David said is the thing that works, that he feels more comfortable with, that Representative Elkins just advised us, if anybody wants to buy one of these things, don't buy the thing that's going to be subsidized by the public. Buy the thing that actually works. So we're not even spending this $30 million on the instrument that the industry is moving toward and that might actually provide the benefits that people need. We're throwing it down the death spiral. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. And O'Driscoll, Representative O'Driscoll, Mr. Chairman, I think you have a great bill here. Could you wrap it up as to why it's so great?
Yeah, again, you know, I have always been in favor of the hybrid product. And Representative Gomez, you've convinced me. I'm going to draft a bill and hope you'll co-author it with me that we're going to put those kinds of credits over there. Because that, as I've been thinking about it, what it does is somebody who's 25, 26 years old goes out and buys a life insurance policy. They don't have the health risks. They're typically underwritten. You're going to be able to have a life insurance policy that will preserve family wealth and individual wealth across all different kinds of demographics and different kinds of communities. That's a great idea, Representative Gomez, and I want to work with you on it. I think that that's the direction we should be looking at going. And then as you get into the age where you would not be able to qualify or the premiums would be so high for a long-term care policy, you've already are invested in the hybrid policy, and then it can convert over. I think it's a wonderful idea, and I'm glad I had the opportunity to be in front of the tax committee to talk about that. And I can assure you that we'll be back in the future working on that type of model, because I think that's the way we should be going. You're going to preserve wealth for a lot of folks, and you're going to bend the curve on folks needing to be taken care of by the social safety network. Great idea. I love it. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll renew my motion to House File 355, be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill. Thank you, and thank you to the witness. Thank you very much. I don't know who wants to go next. House File 881.
Representative Olson.
Thank you.
Welcome to the Tax Committee.
not as bad as they look.
Oh, this is a great committee. Mr. Chairman, if I may.
Representative Olson.
I miss this committee so much. I wish I was on this committee.
Representative Olson, we miss you too. We miss you too. So I will move House File 881, and it'll be to be laid over possible inclusion in omnibus tax bill. Do we have an amendment?
No.
We do not. Bill as is. Okay, two-year, I'll move the bill. A two-year bill, Representative Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House File 881 basically lives under one concept, and that concept is if I hand you a dollar, should you hand me a dollar and 7, 8, or 9 cents back so I can give those, that dime to the state of Minnesota in the form of taxes? It doesn't make sense. Now, there are 44 states in this country that exempt or fully exempt bullion or collectible currency from sales tax. So Minnesota does a portion of that. This bill would expand it to include currency. For those of you who aren't big newsmatics and, you know, numismatists, it's kind of a difficult word to call yourself when you have a hard time pronouncing it. But for those of you who aren't, it's simple. In the state of Minnesota, you can buy silver and gold rounds or bars that are 99.9% pure, and you don't pay the sales tax on that. Now, the problem with that is an ounce of 99.9% gold is almost $3,000, and that places out a lot of people, prices them out of the game. They don't get to play. They don't get to invest in something that many people believe is a very sound investment in their future. Now, not a lot of us can afford stocks. Not a lot of us can do bonds, but I can tell you that a 90% silver dime that was minted in 1964 or before, it's got $2.50 worth of silver in it. And I think that really prices a lot of people into this investment opportunity. Many people can afford to invest $2.50 at a time in something that they have a future moving forward, something tangible, something that they would possess, and something that they could offload if they needed to do so. So I think that what this bill would do by exempting the remainder of this organization or this investment opportunity, we would price in a lot of people into this investment strategy. And also, we would be helping out our small businesses here in the state. There aren't any large, enormous corporate, big business coin dealers in this state. What we would be doing is helping the small business that has to take these taxes in. And people are not dumb. Consumers are not dumb. And they're choosing to go to states, some of the other 44 states that fully exempt currency. The state of Iowa fully exempts it. And they're choosing to go to those coin dealers there. They're choosing to go to Sioux Falls to purchase their coins as well. You know, my big push for this is the concept that a 1964 silver dime is worth $2.50 worth of silver, and that's affordable by all Minnesotans. But if you really want to look and push the envelope, there are some considerably expensive coins out there that are akin to the same price of a car. And if you have to pay 9% sales tax on the price of a car, That ruins your investment. It's not an investment anymore, because then in order to make money on that investment, you would have to see an increase in its value by nearly 10%. But on top of that, you'd have to pay capital gains on it as well. So we're double taxing this investment. You're paying the sales tax on the front end, and when you sell it, you're paying the capital gains tax, and you're pricing people out of this amazing investment strategy. So that's the entirety of this bill. It would put us on par with a lot of the other states in this nation. We would be encouraging our citizens to invest, and we'd be opening the door to a lot of the lower income individuals to actually start thinking about their future in an investment strategy that everyone can afford.
Thank you, Chair Olson. Do we have a J.P. Cortez, I believe? Do you have a witness?
I believe he's online, Mr. Chair.
Oh, online. Let's go online. Let's have him make some comments here. Can we get him going here?
Hi there. Can you hear me?
Yes. Go ahead, Mr. Cortez.
Perfect. Chair Davids, Vice Chair Joy, and the House Taxes Committee, thank you very much for the opportunity to testify before you today. I apologize for not being there in person. I'm actually in Maine right now, working another legislation just like this one. I stand in strong support of House File 881. This is a bill that would expand the current sales tax exemption that already exists on bullion to also cover coins as well. It frankly doesn't make sense that Minnesota is choosing to delineate between bullion and coins like this. There is no other state in the country that chooses to tax bullion and not coins, or vice versa. In 2024, New Jersey and neighboring Wisconsin passed legislation to remove the tax, the sales tax on purchases of gold and silver. And the reason for that is, like the sponsor mentioned, is a big part, big problem with double taxation. In the case of bullion today, you don't charge, you're not paying a sales tax when you buy it, because it's like other assets in that you're charged a capital gain tax when you sell it, if there is a gain. In the case of coins, you're being charged a tax when you purchase the asset, and then again when you sell it. That's not the case with stocks, bonds, mutual funds. Another point I'd like to make is the fiscal impact to the state. There are states larger than Minnesota in population that have passed legislation like this, with in legislation that considers a full exemption of bullion coins across the state, and the fiscal note is very, very minimal. $350,000 in the case of Tennessee. So this would not affect. The fiscal impact to the state of Minnesota would not be enormous. And then lastly, this would just be constitutional. Article 1, Section 10 says the state shall make no thing but gold and silver a tender in payment of debts. We're talking about coins that are literally minted by the U.S. Mint. These are government-made coins. It makes no sense to tax the purchase of them. So with that, I'll stand for any questions. Thank you again for the opportunity to testify today.
Okay, thank you, sir. Before we go to questions, is there anyone else in the audience which testify for the bill or with concerns on the bill? Does the department wish to, which department? Wish, no, okay. Okay, so let's go to questions to the witness, and then we'll go to questions to the author from members. Questions to Mr. Cortez. Okay, thank you very much, Mr. Cortez. Questions for the author.
Thank you.
Okay. So, Chair Gomez.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Great to have another bullion bill in front of us. So I don't have a lot of comments on this. I mean, it's just the kind of thing that's like, we exempt from taxes people buying gold. I just want to like the Department of Revenue, when this originally passed, kind of talked about it as more of an investment in personal property. I mean, we're trying to make this argument that it's like a security or like a stock, and that you can't buy a stock for $2.24, which of course you can. But you know, this is sort of like something bad that we did, making it worse, in my opinion. It's turning something that's a $7 million per biennium into an $11 million per biennium cost. It's just a, you know, this is how we erode our tax base bit by bit, decision by decision. Yes, $4.2 million, $4.9 million as an ongoing cost isn't the biggest fiscal note that we're going to see in taxes. But, you know, we just really, every time we make a little decision to exempt somebody's pet item from the sales tax, we erode our ability to collect revenue down the road. And so, you know, this is not the most expensive or offensive erosion of the tax base that we've seen today or that we'll see this week, but it's still like, why would we possibly be doing this, I guess. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. To the author.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And actually, I tend to think that Chair Gomez's concept is maybe reverse-sided. The concept that you're not encouraging the investment of coins, collectible, bullion, that kind of stuff, I think that actually is an erosion of our tax base. Imagine if we had a state that was fully and freely open to collecting or investing in these items, you're going to see individuals who are going to have to pay a considerably larger amount of capital gains tax, but also estate tax. And I think that if you're talking about offsetting a 7 or a 6.875% sales tax on the front end and exchanging that for an estate sales tax concept on the end, I think that you're going to find that this, in fact, would be a very good investment for the state of Minnesota to encourage individuals in our state to obtain these assets, to make money on these assets, to invest in these assets. I think you would find that we would actually make more money in the form of corporate taxes, estate taxes, and all the other types of taxes that the state tries to use. And I think that when you're talking about the fiscal note that we received from House staff, you know, this bill was heard in the Senate 3 years ago, and I was very interested to see that the Senate 3 years ago came up with less than $1 million worth of cost to the state 3 years ago. And I know that gold has not increased, it's not doubled in price in the last 3 years. And so I'm curious, maybe that's a great sign that this investment strategy is alive and well in this state, or maybe it's some numbers that weren't added appropriately. But I don't know the answer to that. All I can tell you is that 3 years ago it was $1 million fiscal impact, and now we're saying it's going to be a $2 million fiscal impact, which is not a huge erosion in our tax base whatsoever. And I think that the investment by our state in this type of a tax policy would pay dividends in the end. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Chair Olson. I will renew my motion. The House File 881 be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill. Thank you so much. Item next, we go to House File 952, Chairman Kosnick. And I believe there are two witnesses here. Welcome to the Tax Committee, sir, and we miss you too.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Former member of the Tax Committee.
Absolutely. I do miss the love fest of the Tax Committee, but I'm hopeful to bring a bill before the Tax Committee that's just full of joy.
You had to go there. Okay. So I have down as witnesses Mr. Greg Krogstad, Ms. Polita LaPlante, and we have another witness.
I'm just here for questions.
Okay. Answer questions. All right. So please present your bill. I will move House File 952, and this one would also be laid over. So House File 952, the motion is to lay it over. Chair Kosnick, to your bill.
Thank you, Chair Davids. House File 952 helps bring a bit of consistency to the way the landscaping or green industry is taxed. The first provision in the bill ensures that the purchases of detachable equipment is taxable all the time, since it is currently both taxable and non-taxable depending on the use and circumstances. And then the bill also makes land clearing a non-taxable service to avoid the confusion that the industry is currently experiencing. Since under the current tax code, land clearing is also taxable or non-taxable depending on the circumstances. So the two provisions will help avoid confusion for the industry, provide consistency to our tax code, and more joy to Minnesotans.
Fine piece of legislation.
Very fine.
To your testifiers, Mr. Krogstad, please.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Greg Krogstad, and I'm the CEO of Rainbow Tree Companies, which is a Minnesota-based, employee-owned company with over 250 Minnesota employees. We're also a member of the Minnesota Nursery and Landscape Association. I want to thank Representative Kosnick for bringing this bill to your attention today and certainly for the opportunity to testify. House File 952 is a good bill that does bring clarity to Minnesota sales and use tax related to landscaping, green industry, tree businesses like mine. Landscape businesses, they often perform both taxable and non-taxable service using the same detachable equipment, often on the same day, because they do multiple jobs in a day. Sales tax is applied whenever the equipment is purchased or performed on a non-taxable service. Counter to that, the same purchase is considered tax exempt if it's being used on a taxable service. Businesses cannot afford to purchase two separate pieces of detachable equipment and swap them out based on whatever job they're doing. Nor can they spend the time to be switching these back and forth. In this case, we're asking for us to just pay the sales tax. A lot of our companies pay it anyways. We cannot count which jobs or what percentage of jobs we're using it for taxable or non-taxable purposes. So just put sales tax on detachable equipment. These are things like chains and chainsaw bars that affix to a chainsaw. The other provision makes it so that we have clarity on a service that is often called land clearing. The bulk of land clearing we do already today, it falls in a non-taxable bucket. The issue here is there are circumstances in the current law where the services might be deemed taxable or might not be deemed, or might be deemed non-taxable. And it creates confusion, and it exposes businesses to an audit where an auditor's also not sure whether it's a taxable or non-taxable land clearing event. So what we're asking is to make land clearing a non-taxable event, and that just brings clarity so that when people are doing land clearing, they're not confused whether it should or shouldn't be taxable. This business, it will save headaches and supports the small businesses in Minnesota and brings clarity to customers as well. So I want to thank you for the opportunity to speak today, and I as well am available with any for any questions.
Yeah, let's go to the other witness, then we'll come back to question both witnesses. Ms. LaPlante.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and committee members. Thank you for your work and the opportunity to testify on behalf of this bill. And thank you, Representative Kosnick, for bringing this bill to the committee. my name is Paulita LaPlante. I'm the co-owner and chief strategic officer of Prescription Landscape. Founded in 1980, we grew from two people with a dream and two trucks into a four-branch location that provides a complete service line for all exterior landscape needs: grounds maintenance, snow and ice, irrigation, design build, seasonal color, holiday decor. We currently employ 200 year-round employees. We double our staff in the winter to manage snow and ice, when there is snow and ice. These employees are scattered between our branch locations in St. Paul, Shakopee, Crystal, St. Cloud. We're a longstanding member and staunch advocate of the Minnesota Nursery and Landscape Association. I'm here to support House File 952 to clarify Minnesota sales tax and use related to landscaping. Even though we are now a large organization, most of our peers' businesses in this state are small to medium, with limited use and access to full-time accountants or bookkeepers or sophisticated knowledge of accounting software. Our small business landscape providers work outdoors on properties throughout the state. They spend a small percentage of their time on doing all jobs. They're frontline workers, and they also have to come back home at night and be administrators. Determining what services, equipment, materials, and labors require either use or sales tax, and which are taxable and non-taxable, is exceptionally complex and time-consuming, and has resulted in audits, which are very expensive for these small business owners. Greg already detailed separate detachable units. Most vendors charge the sales tax and are confused by the SD3 certificate. We frequently will educate our vendors on the topic and correct them so that we're safe, that we have paid tax and following the law. Another example of the need for this bill, Greg already mentioned this, is land clearing services. I can tell you that on the same property on the same day, we'll be doing land clearing, and that improvements to a real property is a tax-exempt service. Land clearing is taxable if the services are sold for the purpose of remodeling, improvement, or expansion. We can be expanding an existing structure, but the client is also building a new building just a couple of acres away. What about clients that buy a site with an abandoned house and we're asked to demolish the structure and clear the land? Most of the landscape industry and our services are full of these gray areas. And that's why we believe it would be simpler if land clearing became a non-taxable service. And then we would know exactly what to do in any scenario. I truly appreciate your attention and openness to help simplify and add clarity to the tax code for small business owners. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Before we go to member questions, does the department wish to weigh in on this issue? Okay, thank you. Okay, questions from members? Representative Robbins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Kosnick, for bringing this bill. I have heard from so many of the small landscape operators in my district, and I've met with them many times over the years. And it's crazy we haven't gotten this done yet, honestly. This is a group that's willing to get rid of a tax exemption just to simplify the paperwork and make their lives easier. That's how complicated and time-consuming this process is from client to client to client. And so as you see in the fiscal note, what the tax that they're going to now be paying basically offsets the exemption from the land clearing contracts that they're asking for. What they're really asking for is simplification so that they can just spend more time running their businesses. I've never had a group come in here and say we're willing to pay more taxes just to simplify our lives. So please, members, let's get this done this year.
Thank you, Mr. Robbins. That was interesting. I kind of caught that they're asking us to tax them more. That was interesting. But on the land, Representative Kosnick, on the land clearing part, that also could go two ways, right?
That is correct, Mr. Chair, and this bill clarifies when land clearing would be exempt.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Representative Robbins. Representative Johnson, Hewitt, and Anderson. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for bringing this up. This is a perfect example of the difficulties businesses have, especially small businesses, where the person doing the work is also maybe doing the paperwork and doing the and filing for the taxes. An example of you know how confusing our tax code is I have an HVAC company and I have a duct cleaning company. So if we go in and do duct cleaning, we have to collect sales tax. However, if we work on the furnace while we do the duct cleaning, we don't have to pay sales. We don't have to collect sales tax. And so it's so confusing when they started collecting taxes on services, it really made it very confusing, not to mention the increasing work that is required because every community now wants to put a sales tax on. And so then you have multiple levels. But this is, you know, I appreciate you coming up forward, but this just highlights again how burdensome and confusing and what a challenge it is for businesses, small businesses in Minnesota to try and keep up with the unique ways that we write laws down here and what we decide to tax, what we don't decide to tax. So I think any way that we can simplify the rules for our small businesses that continue to have new mandates put on them, we should be doing. So thank you.
Thank you, Representative Johnson. Representative Hewitt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess that I'm wondering what, like what services are taxed? Like you're saying land clearing, is snow removal taxable? Can you give us more details on what we're taxing and what we're not? Thank you.
President Kosnick?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hewitt, on line 2.6, 2.7, it talks about, to this bill, land clearing, tree, brush, shrub, and stump removals are exempt when sold to contractors and subcontractors. And then the bill goes on, it's exempt to develop a site or a portion of a site. And so it clarifies that now when they clear a portion of a site for a contractor, subcontractor, it will also be exempt. It does not talk about snow removal.
Okay, and Mr. Chair.
Representative Hewitt.
So you're not talking about snow removal, but you're looking at just this area here. Do landscape companies pay sales tax or charge sales tax for their services, like if I have them come and plant a tree or do some landscaping, is that taxable?
Ms. LaPlante?
Yes, it is.
Yeah. Okay. It is. So in our business, can I answer this?
Speak for the chair. Oh.
Yes,
Mr. Krogstad?
Yes, thank you. Mr. Chair, our in our business, 100% of the services we do are taxed. We, if you prune a tree, if you prune a shrub, if you remove a tree in a landscape, you're improving the landscape or you're adjusting the landscape, those are all taxed services in the state of Minnesota. So this clarification deals with when a company is clearing the land, clearing the lot, to put in a, it's called a structure. In the current law, it's very confusing when that's taxable or not taxable.
Mr. Chair, one last, because I'm having some trouble tracking here, but I think I get it. So, like, if you buy a tree from Gertens and you resell it to your client, that's taxable, you've got that tax exempt, and that's able to go, but this stuff you're talking about is just applying to land clearing. Am I right on those two issues there?
Urshel Kosnick?
If I understood the question right, if they buy a tree wholesale and then sell it to a homeowner, that is still taxable. That's not what this bill deals with. It deals with the land clearing. If they have some property and they have some trees and they want to add an outbuilding or an addition to a garage or something, they need to take down the trees or shrubs and remove stumps and so that the contractor can go ahead and put the new structure on there. That land clearing would then be tax exempt as it is if they were just clearing the lot originally.
I'm good, Chair. I'll take any other questions offline with the Representative Kosnick. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Hewitt. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, and I'll be brief. I just wanted to thank you for bringing this bill. Tax policy should be clear for small businesses, and obviously it's not so in this case. So I hope that we support this and put this in the omnibus tax bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Anderson. Representative Chair Joachim.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Kosnick, for bringing this bill forward. I carried it last year, and they had a provision in that made it a little more complicated. I'm glad they worked on it, and I support the bill.
Thank you, Chair Joachim. Any other questions for members? Okay, with that, Chair Gomez.
This is obviously, we can see from the conversation here today, this is super confusing, and we should clear it up. I'm glad to see this bill come forward with a much lower revenue impact than it had last biennium. I think that's like the only reason that it didn't end up in our bill that we brought forward was just because it was a several million dollar, you know, kind of biennial cost. And so glad to see this come forward, and I appreciate you all for working on it, and Rep. Kosnick for bringing it forward. Thanks.
Thank you, Chair Gomez. To the author, you'd like to wrap it up?
I do miss the Love Fest here at the Tax Committee. I appreciate the committee's support.
And we do it with joy.
And you do it with joy, and joy and professionalism and humor, Mr. Chair. And just for the record, the testifier is Greg with two G's.
I noticed that. Not three. Okay. So with that, I will renew my motion that House File 952 be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Kosnick. Okay, item last, we will go to Chair Joachim will move House File 805. And I don't believe there's any amendments. Okay, Chair Joachim moves House File 805. We have a witness, Kylie Cooper. That makes sense? Okay. Okay, so to your bill, Chair Joachim.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, members, for hearing House File 805 today. This bill is about leveling the playing field among our nonprofit child care centers. Currently, nonprofit child care centers that own their building are exempt from property taxes, but those who rent space for their facility do not receive any property tax exemptions. The idea for this bill was brought to me by one of our local early child care centers in Hopkins, Kids Zone. Kids Zone was originally located in St. Louis Park with a church building where they were able to receive a property tax exemption. Due to a portion of the church being sold for development for multi-use housing, the child care center had to relocate. The property then rented in Hopkins was an old commercial building, and Kids Zone quickly found out that they no longer qualified for the property tax exemption, even though their nonprofit status hadn't changed. When I took a tour of the new facility, I asked what some of their barriers were to being able to provide affordable services to their families and livable wages to their employees. The cost of their rent was near the top of their list. So I did a little research and realized the inequity in the statutes. The bill would provide a property tax refund for nonprofit daycares who rent their facilities and mirror some of the savings their counterparts who own the buildings receive. It is structured similar to a renter's credit, with the owner of the building providing a certificate of gross rent paid to the owner of the child care center that is renting in their building. The owner of the child care center would be able to submit the certificate along with an appropriate paperwork to show their nonprofit status to the Department of Revenue for a refund that would equal about 10% of their gross rent paid. We chose to go this route because I didn't want to shift that property tax burden onto other properties in the jurisdiction. Chair and members, our child care facilities are facing major challenges. Many of you have heard bills throughout the years around this. This is one way to provide them with a little bit of relief in their overhead. With me today, I have the director of another one of our amazing nonprofit daycares in St. Louis Park, Kylie Cooper, executive director of Rise Early Learning Center.
And hi. Welcome to the Tax Committee. Please state your name and who you represent for the record, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Kylie Cooper. I am the executive director for Rise Early Learning Center, and the aspiring tax expert here is Louise. I'm here to voice my support for this bill. This bill really reduces the overhead costs for nonprofit child care providers and evens out an existing inequity that is really just a product of whether you rent or own. Our center opened in early 2024, and you've all heard the challenges that exist in running a child care program. We wouldn't have had the capital when we opened our doors to purchase the land outright, and so renting made it possible for us to open 62 slots for our community and provide affordable, high-quality child care in a pretty short amount of time. The low margins that already exist in early childhood, they result in low stagnant wages for staff and heightened cost of tuition that ends up being shouldered by parents. For us specifically, about 80% of our annual budget is allocated to staff salaries and benefits, and the remaining is what we spread over the rest of running our business. There's not a lot of space to work with. Nearly half of all licensed child care centers in Minnesota are not-for-profit. Often, and like mine, these centers serve a vastly broad population of families with demonstrated needs who come through our doors every day. Our state has a growing shortage of child care slots, and the barriers to open new programs are plenty. This bill is a step in the right direction, alleviating a small portion of the cost to operate a high-quality child care facility, allowing them to allocate funds where they can be the most impactful, back in the pockets of parents, back in the pockets of the educators, without adding that penalty to the property owner. I firmly support any creative solution that generates positive outcomes and opportunities for families and children, and I urge successful passage of this bill. Thank you for your time and consideration.
And thank you. Any questions for Ms. Cooper? Is there anyone else in the audience like to testify for the bill or with concerns? Would the department like to weigh in? Okay. So members' questions for the Chair Joachim or the witness? Well, we didn't have any for the witness, so Chair Joachim. Representative Anderson.
Thank you. I guess that's a question for nonpartisan. So I think we've heard bills in this committee about property tax exemptions or for family child care that are in homes. Is there any exemptions right now for home-based child care? Refunds or any kind of exemptions?
We need Mr. Clay or Dole? Mr. Swanson? Oh, yeah, that's quite the. Okay. Mr. Williams.
Chair Davids and members, I'm being told no by Mr. Swanson.
Representative Anderson.
Okay, thanks. I'm just curious because I understand, you know, Chair Joachim, where you're going with this and why as compared to some of the nonprofits that own buildings. I just want to make sure if we're thinking in terms of fairness that we're looking at all child care centers, also. So I know there's been other bills that have talked about that too. So thank you.
Thank you, Representative Anderson. Mm-hmm. Representative Joy.
Thank you, Chair Davis. And thank you, Chair Joachim, for this. How will we know this will lower child care costs? You know, that's one of the questions we hear a lot when we try to take in-home daycares or we try to do things. How will we know that this can, you know, when you talked about how it's affecting the budget, how will we know that this will affect lowering the child care costs?
Chair Joachim.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And first I wanted to answer Representative Anderson's question. House File 633 is moving through about home child care centers. There's a handout in your packet from MCCA supporting this bill and also mentioning it's just one of the steps that should be taken. As for the other representative's question, Mr. Representative Joy, just like we do with any tax expenditures, we hope that it does move down to the folks that are part of the program. But the most important thing about this bill is it actually is just treating like companies like. It's leveling the playing field. It just seems odd that you'd, if only if you owned it, you'd get it, but if you rent it, you don't. And we do have a renter refund for some of the exact same reasons. And it's about 10% of their gross receipts is what they'd receive in a refund.
Vice Chair Joy.
Thank you.
Okay, any other questions? Representative Robbins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Chair Joachim, for bringing this bill. I just wondered, why is it limited to nonprofits that rent? Would for-profit child cares that rent not be eligible?
Chair Joachim.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Robbins. I just wanted to start with leveling the playing field. That's a discussion the committee can have going on. But I know the tight constraints of our budgets around here nowadays, so I just wanted to make sure that like companies were treated alike.
Chair Robbins.
Thank you. I just am not sure how that levels it when the nonprofit sector would get it and the for-profit providers who rent would not.
Okay. Comment. Chair Joachim.
Oh, Chair Davids. Thank you, Representative Robbins. I'm just focusing on the nonprofit that own already do, so just making sure the ones that rent do. They serve some of the neediest population and families that don't have a ton of money.
Chair Robbins. Okay. Any other, Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Chair. And thank you, Chair Joachim, for bringing this forward. I really appreciate that you've identified really clear measurables of how we can know that who this care is being provided to, right? You have in here that this is going to assist families on the CCAP program, knowing that these are centers that are helping folks who need help paying for child care the most and are actually providing some of the care that is holding society together. So thank you for those really clear, identifiable things in here. And also understanding that this is a clear direction that came out of the Great Start compensation support programs and a lot of the recommendations that have been coming out of our committee. So thank you for taking what's been talked about in different task forces, turning it into a policy and bringing it before us today. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Representative Hansen. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for bringing this forward. As a nonprofit daycare, do you have criteria that goes along with ability to pay, how much they make, and stuff like that with your daycare? In other words, I guess that's my question, Mr. Chair. Is do you have criteria for people who can take advantage of your daycare?
Ms. Cooper?
Chair Davids. Yes, so I can't speak for every single nonprofit childcare, but I can speak to how we structure we have essentially a sliding fee scale. 60% of our slots are allocated or earmarked for families who have a demonstrated need. So in that 60%, we have a combination of families who receive CCAP and meet those eligibility indicators. We have another handful of families who utilize the early learning scholarships. And then we have an internal scholarship stream for 7 children of our 62 slots that includes a significant offset of the annual cost for families. And that's all need and income, needs-based and income-based. So short answer would be yes, we follow a sliding fee scale, but I can only speak to my nonprofit.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Follow-up question. Since you are providing, lower fees and nonprofit, do you have other sources or where are your sources of funding coming from?
Ms. Cooper.
Chair Davids, we braid a lot of different funding streams to make this work possible. My annual budget for our 62 slot center is about $1.6, $1.7 million a year. We combine tuition dollars and what's coming in for the cost there, but we also rely on about 14% of community donations and grants throughout the course of a year. I try to keep that number as low as possible to make sure that we're solvent into the future and we can continue to support families. But our ability to be flexible and to meet individual needs relies on our income.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Any other member questions? I'll go to Chair Gomez. Any wrap-up comments? Okay, then let's, before we go to the author to wrap this one up, tomorrow's agenda, House File 1359, a Johnson Bill Score Grants, House File 1829, Davidsville Homestead Resort Property Tax Modifications, House File 290, Representative Anderson, and then House File 1933, Representative Herr. So that's for tomorrow. And if you'd like to wrap up the bill that you have moved, House File 805, Chair Joachim.
Thank you, Chair Davids and members. Thank you for your time and attention and your questions today.
What?
Our child care centers across Minnesota are facing many challenges. This bill is only one way to level the playing field and provide them with some relief in their budgets. I would ask for your support as this bill moves forward into a tax bill. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Chair Joachim. Chair Joachim renews her motion that House File 805 be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill. Anything else for the good of the order? With that, good government all the time. We're adjourned.